everyone. My name is Sam Willens, your mother of Valkyries and your host of the Sword and the Ribbon podcast. Today, I am chatting with Elise Zellmer, LMFT, aka a licensed therapist and a Valkyrie Squad member. She basically has a master's degree in keeping secrets, with legal caveats, of course. She is passionate about helping people and loves when books are able to display mental health struggles realistically. The content provided in this episode is intended for education, informational, and entertainment purposes only. Seek the advice of a medical or mental health provider regarding any questions or concerns you have about your medical and/or mental health needs. Fast forward to the end of the episode for full legal disclaimer. Hello, Elise.
Hello, Sam.
How are you?
I am good. It is hot here today, so I am trying to stay inside and out of the sun as much as I possibly can.
Amazing. Well, thank you so much for coming on the podcast today.
You're very welcome.
I am so excited for all of the things that we're going to talk about in this episode. But for our listeners outside of Valkyrie Squad, can you tell us a bit about yourself?
Sure. I absolutely hate this question because I am the worst at any sort of like, tell me who you are. I don't know. I'm just me. But let's see. I am an Enneagram 5. I'm a Sagittarius, a House Ravenclaw who unshockingly devours books like Amryn Horde's Jewels. I've got a mate. We've been married about 10 years or so at this point.
Ooh.
A scruff nugget of a dog named Jax, who is sleeping over here beside me today. The big spoon is death. My undergrad was in advertising from Middle Tennessee State University. My master's in arts is in marriage and family therapy from Liberty University. And while I don't regret the degree, I often regret the choice of schools.
I feel like that always happens.
Yeah.
I like this, but why did I go here?
Yeah, that's how that happens. I know why I went there. It was cheap and easy.
In the United States? Yes, understandable.
Yeah. So that was the choice there. And that's basically me. I like being outside. I like the cold weather. I love to read.
Amazing. You're a Ravenclaw and you're an Enneagram 5. My husband's an Enneagram 5, so
I'm sorry. I love being an Enneagram 5, but we are absolutely the worst when it comes to relationships sometimes. So I apologize now.
Well, he's a Slytherin, and I don't know if that makes it worse or better.
It doesn't have to be better or worse. It could just be the thing it is.
Yeah, he's an interesting person. So, yeah, I know. I have another friend who's a 5, but yeah, I'm well-versed.
We're special.
Yes, yes. But we love you all the same.
Thanks.
I'm an Enneagram 8, and then I think when I'm stressed, it goes to Enneagram 5. I think that's how it works.
That is how it works, yes.
I understand on some level.
Which is why I get along great with 8s. 8s don't always get along great with me because I remind them of when they're not healthy and in control.
Let's not open that can of worms.
But I go to 8. Like, when I'm really feeling safe and secure, I move into a very 8 space. And so that's why I'm like, yeah, you're cool. I like you. You make me feel healthy and confident.
I get this. Well, I guess that can bridge us over into the healthy confidence of Valkyrie Squad. And how did you find Valkyrie Squad?
TikTok, like everyone else. Unlike everyone else, I saw one of your videos pop up. And I was like, ugh. Another influencer trying to sell something that's not actually going to work. And I swiped away real quick. And I was like, oh, not doing that today. And but then I was like, somebody out there has to have a Nesta workout. And so I started searching. It led me back to the Micro Squad. And then the almighty algorithm was like, you really need to see some more Valkyrie TikTok. And just kept pushing. And I was like, all right, well, I'll look into it. And so I did. And I found out it wasn't just another influencer trying to sell something that wasn't going to work. I know we've talked about the stupid body book that TikTok keeps, Beyond Body or whatever it is. I know that's been talked about many times. And so I'd kind of put you in that category. And then I found out you weren't. And I was like, great. These people are awesome.
I love and appreciate your honesty so much. I believe that's the Enneagram 5 trait.
Yeah, no, it is.
I recognize it.
Yeah. So that's how I found you guys. And then after that, it was just written in stone. Like, it was like, all right, this seems legit. Let's do it.
I love this journey. Nope. Stupid influencer.
Stupid. And I am too skeptical about everything.
Fair enough. Again, I think that five part of me completely understands that.
Yeah, absolutely.
So how long have you been part of the Valkyrie Squad?
So I am terrible with time. It is a made up construct that has no meaning in my life whatsoever.
Aren't you a therapist?
So yeah, absolutely. Keep time? I'm real bad at it. I have to have like alarms set on my watch to be like, okay, it's time for you to go. Because I'll just sit and talk with you all day. So I think it was that like pocket dimension time between Christmas and New Year's where nobody knows what time it is.
Oh, yes.
It just exists outside of everything. I'm pretty sure that's when I joined. I couldn't tell you how many months ago that was because time.
I bet you we could actually go into the Discord and see when you joined Valkyrie Squad.
Probably. But that seems like a lot of work.
Yeah, it does seem like a lot of work, and I don't want to do it either.
So, like, I don't know, what is that, 4-ish, 5-ish months maybe?
It's a decent amount of time. You've been around for a while, and what is your favorite part of the program?
I absolutely love the flexibility and how the Valkyrie Squad focuses on progress, not perfection. I also love that I can do it in my own home with no prying eyes. And so if I mess something up, nobody has to know. And that there's a whole group out there who are always there to offer your support at whatever level you want it.
Yes. Our unexpected community.
Yeah.
It's amazing. It really is amazing. I think this is always the thing we talk about in every episode. It's the community.
Yeah. Because, I mean, that's honestly what gets you staying. You join because you want to get your body healthy. You stay because of the community.
Exactly. That's well said. Now, I feel like this is an obvious question. Would you recommend it?
Hell yeah. Yeah, because it's more than a workout. It's a whole community that exists at your preferred level of engagement. So if you're not somebody who's like, I'm super engaged and I want to talk to people all the time, you don't have to. But if you are, then there is a vibrant and active community that you can be a part of.
Exactly. So enough about Valkyrie Squad. Let's talk a little bit more about you.
Okay.
Oh, I know. I'm the worst. I'm the worst at self-promotion as well.
Okay, great. I'm glad I'm in good company.
Yes, I'm just like, you want me to talk about my business?
I mean, I do a thing.
Yeah, like, I post all the time. Can't you just get the information from there? Do I need to verbally tell you? So what made you decide to become a therapist?
The shortish version of it is that I fought it for a really long time.
I'm seeing a trend here.
Yes. No, I don't do anything easily. But I've always been my friend's therapist. I'm always the one my friends come to for advice. And to some extent, I also played a little bit of that role within my family of origin. And secondly, I was raised Southern Baptist. And I got to watch how abysmally the institutionalized church has handled matters of sex and intimacy. And I wanted to offer people better than that. And so when I finally stopped running from it, it was a no-brainer after that and got myself enrolled in a program and did the work.
That's amazing. I love the journey of that and what you recognized in, I would just say, or even it may not be your community, but the community you were a part of. I have several friends, and I'm sure people listening have had similar experiences of how the church has handled all of that.
Not well is the answer to that one, so when I'm being at my kindest.
Yes. It was not handled in the best way, but luckily there are people like you helping many, many people. So I guess that also bridges us into what area of therapy do you specialize in?
So I see a lot of trauma clientele from a variety of backgrounds. I am also pursuing my certification as a sex therapist. And if I can ever remember to record sessions with permission, of course, I could probably get those 3 hours of supervision I need to be certified in no time flat. But I'm real bad about remembering to be like, hey, can you mind if we record this session? And then we get to the end and I'm like, that would have been a great session to record. So I get, I do see a lot of sexual issues from trauma to sex education, and then a lot of garden variety stuff, depression, anxiety, but mostly trauma work of varying degrees.
That's definitely where your passion lies then.
Yes, I especially like complex trauma. It's a lot of fun for me.
I was like, a lot of people call it fun. No. Would you say it's like maybe like solving a puzzle for you?
It is. I always call it a tapestry. And like when people say something, it like triggers this snarl that I can just feel in the back of my head, where like the threads aren't quite lining up the way they're supposed to. And if I can just unpick it, everything will smooth back out again.
That is a beautiful analogy. I've never like that. That was so good.
Yeah. So that's how my mind conceptualizes all of that. And that's how I do my work.
That's so amazing. Wow.
It's a messy cross stitch.
For all our crafters out there, they will fully understand that one. So you and I have talked a little bit about it, but you talk about using bibliotherapy. And why is this the first time I am even hearing about it? Because it definitely sounds like my kind of therapy.
It's not something that is like a... Okay, so within the therapeutic world, there is like evidence-based ideas, which have a lot of research behind them. And so most therapists really want to gravitate towards those evidence-based interventions, because that's what insurances are looking for. They want something that is founded in, we have the research. It shows that cognitive behavioral therapy works. Bibliotherapy doesn't have a lot of research. It also doesn't have like any sort of like, real like certifying board. There are some classes you can take in it, but it is, which is probably why you haven't heard of it, because it's not like a super popular modality, but a lot of therapists use it in one way or another. And it's basically a form of creative therapy that utilizes storytelling and how a person interacts with the content of a story to promote healing and growth and all of those sorts of things. It often overlaps with like writing exercises. So it's not a modality for everyone, but it works well for people who are really passionate about books and stories most of the time. So I use it a lot.
Well, now that we know you're Ravenclaw, it makes complete sense.
Right? Right. I mean, like my mate told me, we're never moving again. Because if we do, he has to burn all of my books because he's not moving my books anymore. And I said, that grounds for divorce. You'll be dead. But I do. I hoard books. I have too many of them and not enough.
A lot of people will completely understand. I know this is not how this works at all, but like, I know you're not a psychiatrist, but do you like prescribe books to people? Like, that's the only way my brain is like conceptualizing this. It's like, your prescription book today is...
Yes. Usually I call it homework. Hey, I want you to go home and read this book. I think that there are some things in there you really connect with. That's usually how we word that. And they can be anything. Sometimes it's educational books. Which is where a lot of therapists slide into using bibliotherapy, where it's like, hey, this is a book that seems to fit where you're at. It's going to give you the vocabulary and the educative pieces you need to be able to really tackle what you're trying to talk about, but don't really have the things to talk about. So it's like educated bibliotherapy, which is great. I love it. I use it all the time. And then there's like literature bibliotherapy, where sometimes for some people, it's helpful to be like, hey, I really think some of the themes in this book are going to resonate with you and kind of give you a grasp outside of yourself that you can make sense and structure what you're going through. And so I will. I'll be like, I usually find out what kind of books they like to read. Not everybody is a fantasy. Some people are really into true crime. Those are harder. Or like spy fiction or urban fantasies, fiction, stuff like that. And so if I can find out, if you love books and I know what genre you like, I can generally be like, hey, I think this book would be good for you. I think there's some themes in this book that would be helpful for you. And then I have them go read it. And then we talk about it.
I don't want to group all of these books into that, but just fictional, but like fantasy books versus your typical educational books. So like I've been given those by therapists and it's like, I suck at reading those. I may read one like once every 2 years. That's it.
They're not fun. Most of them aren't fun.
No.
Sometimes if you find the right one, that just fits. It's not fun, but it's also like what your body needed. And so you're like, it's the ones you rush to the end of because you just know it fits. You're like, oh my gosh, this makes so much sense about my life. But those are pretty rare, educatively.
I have a friend who can like pound through like 4 or 5 in a year. I'm like, I can't do that. I'm proud of you, but I can't do that.
I read a lot of them.
Yeah. Well, in your profession, I can completely understand. I'm like, nah, let's go over here. I don't want to go over there.
Yeah, no, I get it. If I can give it as a fiction book, I will absolutely give it as a fiction book. So much more fun.
Totally. So since we're on the book topic,
okay,
we're on book talk, not talk. Let's do some quick rapid fire book questions.
All right, let's go.
And what are your three favorite top books? Top three favorite books?
Workbooks or pleasure books?
Pleasure. Let's just do pleasure.
Okay, pleasure books. Definitely Lord of the Rings, In the Shelter by Padraig O'Tooma. And probably the third would have to be either, no, it'd probably be 32 Words for Field by Mancan Magan.
I've not heard of the last two at all.
The last two are both Irish authors. And so Padraig is a poet. So he has several books of poetry. But In the Shelter is just a beautifully written book about how language shapes who we are and how it helps us figure out how we fit into our place in the world.
Ooh.
Yeah, it's good.
Okay, so we're going to have to add these to our show notes because I don't know how to spell any of this. I'm not going to remember this.
I could make that happen. I could send that over. And then 32 Words for Field is about how the land shapes language. And so he's looking at the Irish language and how it has been shaped by the land of Ireland and Irish people's connection to the land through language. It's pretty good.
Oh, that's fascinating.
Yeah.
Well, your next rapid fire question is, what is your favorite series?
Lord of the Rings, for sure.
Felt like that was obvious from the previous question.
Yeah.
So out of the three, we'll just pick the three. We won't include The Hobbit. Which one of the three is your favorite?
That is a trick question. There is no three individual books. Tolkien meant for them to be all one book. And his editor and publisher was like, no, we need to split this into three. So they are not three separate books. They are all one book from beginning to end.
Yes, that I do know.
Two Towers is the worst, though.
I've not read the books. I've only read The Hobbit, so I don't have a say in this one. I barely remember the Two Towers movie, so.
Yeah. I mean, it's beautifully written. It is supposed to be despairing, and you are supposed to be like, ugh, by the time you get to the end of it. And you are.
Probably why I really don't remember anything of it.
Yeah.
We just filmed the Two Towers workout, and the whole time Lydia was teaching it, I was like, wow. I barely remember these points. I was like, oh, shit. Okay.
It's the despair and hopeless portion of Lord of the Rings. We're good. Nobody likes that one.
Yeah, we pushed that workout out. We're going to go to the Return of the King next.
Yes, 100%.
So what is your favorite Sarah J. Maas book and character? They can be totally separate.
That one's tricky. Book-wise, it's probably a toss-up between A Court of Silver Flames and Empire of Storms.
Ooh.
And Nesta has always had a place in my heart from her very first appearance. Dorian and Manon would probably be second, close second. Dorian and Manon. But yeah, so that's who I'm going to go with.
They're all very strong characters.
I know. I don't like picking favorites. I don't want anybody to feel left out.
We love them all.
We love them all. They all have something good to say.
Yes. Well, not all of them. If we're talking about
the
main.
No, they all have good to say.
Do they, though? I think all of us are thinking of a certain character from a very certain first book.
Yes. We'll talk about it later.
Okay.
Fine. It's fine.
It's fine. Okay. Well, speaking of ACOTAR, let's winnow all the way back to the topic of therapy. I think a lot of us were so drawn and moved by the series A Court of Thorns and Roses by how trauma was portrayed in the books. Do you think Sarah J. Maas did a good job at portraying trauma and mental health?
I do. It's a difficult and nuanced subject matter to trap into a book or into a story. So, you know, like there's some stuff she could have probably done better, but for narrative sense, couldn't really make it any different. But for the most part, she's done really well. Especially with some of the stuff that she probably hasn't experienced all of the traumas that she has portrayed in the book. It can be very hard to portray trauma accurately if you've not experienced it or if you've not sat and studied it and sat with other people's stories about it. But she does it decently well with care.
Yes.
Gives you the space to work it out.
I've definitely heard of other, not her, but other authors who kind of just skim the surface of trauma and it's not.
They do, but we're starting to see more and more of it being handled well. There are some things that Sanderson does really well. There are some things that he doesn't. And same for Brent Weeks. There's some stuff that he includes really well in his stories, and there's some stuff that he doesn't. But that's going to be the case whenever you're writing from anybody's perspective.
Yeah, and you can't encase all the trauma.
No.
You can't. It's hard to write, like you said earlier, like it's hard to write trauma if you haven't experienced that specific trauma yourself.
And nobody wants to read that accurate of a description of trauma in their fantasy book.
No, we just need just enough. Just enough to get it.
Yeah.
So let's dig a little deeper and find out who you are. Okay, into mental health, actually. And yes, that is from Princess and the Frog for all those who needed to know. And I have to always sing on an episode, apparently.
We love it.
Random thoughts that become songs. If my life was a musical. Okay, so mental health and ACOTAR. And let's talk about the Acheron sisters trauma and then the Valkyries trauma. From a licensed mental health professional, can you explain your thoughts on each of the characters?
Yeah, absolutely. Who do you want to start with?
Let's start with Feyre.
Okay. Feyre, like all of the Acheron sisters, give us a look into some complex trauma where it's been a part of their life for so long they don't know what their life is like without it. And we really get to see how each one of them responds individually. For Feyre, we see that she takes on a really parentified role where she's the one who has to take care of everything and keep the family together. The oddity there is that she's the youngest, and typically that's not a role we see being put onto the youngest, but she does, and she does it really well, but because she can't be free to develop as she would naturally develop, she, you know, kind of gets stuck in this survival space that she gets to start coming out of once she kills the wolf.
Yes.
And crosses the wall.
You
have questions.
I do. I say, like, I'm glad you brought up the younger sibling, older sibling, because when I read the book, I for sure thought Feyre was the oldest. And I know I literally read that she was the youngest, but it wasn't until like halfway through, I was like, wait, she's the youngest?
Yeah.
Like when she returned to her family, I was like, what? How did it was just so, because I'm the oldest in my family and I have a 7-year age gap between my sisters. I understand that, like, my parents got divorced when I was 11. So like I became the parent to my sister. So I was like, I see everything that Feyre is doing. She's the oldest. No,
she was not. And it's not, I mean, we do see it in families of origin where the oldest doesn't take on that mantle, but there's usually something that stops that from taking place. Occasionally, if the oldest is male and the second is female, then the female will take on that role based off of societal ideas of what is responsible according to gender roles. Or if there's an illness, we sometimes see the next sibling step in and take that over. And so that's kind of one of those where it's not an improbability. I mean, it is an improbability. It's not statistically impossible, but it is something that would be pretty rare.
Yeah, definitely you don't see it often. But like, I'm laughing because it's ACOTAR and I can hear everyone. I can hear everyone listening. Just like I hear you all when I'm teaching. So Tamlin helps her in book one. We're just right at this moment talking about book one.
Yes. So Tamlin gets a bad rap for good reason. This is not Tamlin apologist at this point in the game, but he was her good enough for right now relationship. He wasn't a particularly healthy relationship, but he was the healthiest relationship that Feyre had ever had up to that point. And he gave her space to begin to come out of that survival mode where she didn't have to worry about being taking care of anyone else. She could just focus on the things that brought her pleasure until the end of the first book.
Then we get to the end, then there's a whole other.
And then there's a whole other re-traumatization and re-examining of the people you can trust and who are going to be there for you and the ideas of betrayal and how those play into who we think we are. But we also see with that one, And this is one of those, like, we can't know for sure until we are told that that's how Tamlin was experiencing it. But from a therapeutic standpoint, what I see is that Tamlin's responding to his own trauma of the situation. And through that, because of how that changed him and how that changed her, what they both needed were at odds. And so there was no further growth capable there between the two of them, because he needed to be able to protect and control, and she needed the freedom to continue to explore who she was. And that happens. I see it all the time. And people beat themselves up for it. And it's like, I mean, like, he was healthy until he wasn't. she was healthy until she wasn't.
Further proves that people do change over time, and there's so many instances that can factor in.
Yes, absolutely.
Now, Feyre's growth through everyone's favorite Mist and Fury, and then into Wings and Ruin, and we'll kind of stop Feyre's journey to Wings and Ruin, end of Wings and Ruin. Like how she progressed and changed through those books.
Yes, through that she starts to like really get a hold of who she is, but you also still see her dealing with some lingering guilt and some anger. And we really see that through how she interacts with Tamlin after that break, after she is with Rhys for as long as she is with Rhys. You see her go back and do everything that she does in the Spring Court. And she goes a little overboard. Not gonna lie.
Just a wee bit.
And within that, instead of progressing forward in her own healing and in her own growth, she seeks out revenge. And it kind of comes back and bites her in the butt later, as it should. But it's also understandable, you know, like she doesn't have somebody walking beside her being like, hey, maybe we should slow down. Maybe we should think about how to do this in a way that is good and healthy for everyone involved. Instead, she's trying to figure this all out on her own, and she's doing the best that she knows how. And so she does. Causes a lot of damage along the way that probably could have been avoided, more or less. And finds her way to repentance in some form or fashion from that and being okay with who she is and where she's at.
Yeah, I think it's like the point where she goes to the mirror and Ouroboros mirror.
Yes, and she finally faces all of the dark stuff about herself in that moment. And when you do that, that's when you can really start to grow. It lines up with the idea of radical acceptance. Like we don't have to like those parts of ourselves, but they are a part of who we are. And we have to learn how to work with them so that they don't overtake and make us do things that are later going to be regrets.
I think that was from my standpoint of like the Ouroboros mirror and that whole sequence. I actually wish that had been flushed out a bit more.
Yes.
Because like you said, like radical acceptance would have been amazing to hear her inner dialogue.
Yes.
Of what she was seeing and how she was processing all that. Because then the next thing she's like, boom, got this. I'm like, no, I wanted rewind, bonus chapter.
In the narrative context, like, I understand why that wasn't shown and why it was more told. And the hints are there, but I would have loved to have seen that because there are some very dark parts of who Feyre is, as are all of us have. But after that point, that is when she realizes she can use those things well. She can use those things for good instead of using those things to completely destroy. And it's great.
There's a balance.
Always. Life is always about balance.
Yes. Well, I think that wraps up Feyre a bit. And this is going to be a tough one. So Elaine, since we don't know too much about her, we won't speculate and hover on her too long. Especially since there are some serious opinions out there about what's to come for her.
Yes, I am so excited to see Elaine's story because we don't get to see her trauma and how it affects her and how she's grown from that. We get hints at it, we start to get those hints in Frost and Starlight, which is where we first start to get those hints about Nesta too. But in A Court of Silver Flames, that's where we get some of the bigger hints about Elaine is not this doll. Elaine is not this perfect child that her siblings have always considered her to be, that she does have some backbone. So her story is going to be interesting, but we only have her trauma from other people's perspective, which she highlights for us and been like, hey, you only thought about how this trauma affected you, how my trauma has affected you. You've never considered how my trauma affected me, which is the line that makes me so fascinated to see what her story is going to be. Because within that, there is this idea of knowing, like she seems to know herself better in some ways than either of her sisters have ever known themselves. But we also get to see the role that she was pushed into the family, how her mom felt about her, how her siblings felt about her. And she was the one that always had to be protected. And for a long time, she fulfilled that role. We're going to find out if she liked that role or not. Someday, maybe.
Sarah J. Maas would write.
And she writes really quick. Like, I can't, like, she is consistent, and I love it, but I need them faster, man.
Yeah, they just just a little bit faster, please. Well, I guess we'll have to bring you back for another episode when we get that book.
Happy to do it.
Good, because we're all going to need to whole case study on it. Moving on to the oldest sister, Nesta.
Oh, Nesta. Much like her father, I have loved her from her first existence. In Nesta, we see someone who has spent their whole life trying to figure out the rules and to live in according to those rules, especially in a world that doesn't seem to really fit for who she is. And because of that, she comes off as really cold and aloof, when in fact, she feels everything very deeply and recognizes that that is going to get used against her at some point. And so she keeps it all tucked up tight. All of it, the good and the bad. And I love seeing her story, especially with Feyre doing the narration up into A Court of Silver Flames, which is where you really first start to see that shift of knowing what Nessa's story is versus how she appears to Feyre. And you notice it on the solstice night where she's really cold and sitting next to the fire. And then in The Court of Silver Flames, we find out why that's true for her. And everybody just thinks she's being a cold bitch and doesn't want to interact. And she's fighting her own demons in that moment, but doesn't know how to tell anybody else. And so, like the rest of her sisters, the trauma she's experienced leads her to this isolation of not being able to share the load with anybody else, and that they all have to carry their own load, which is really isolating, because you think, my siblings don't care about me, so I have to do all of this on my own. And that's not the case. And so we see her fight the only way that she knows how. And we see her avoid the things that she might actually want because of the sense of loss of control that would give her to engage in it. And we're lucky that she has Cassian, who is smart enough to figure all of those things out and push her in all of the right ways with the invitation instead of the demand. And so we get to see her healing process, which is completely different than Feyre's healing process.
Well, they have two very different traumas too.
They do. And that affects everybody differently. They have shared trauma, but they also have two very distinct different traumas, which will affect everyone differently. That's Nesta. She's a little spitfire.
She is. And I know all of us love her.
Love
her. We all see, I think we all see bits of ourselves in these characters, and that's why we all just connected so much with them.
Yes. And I think everybody can resonate with that part, that fighting part of Nesta.
Yes, completely. Well, I know we don't have enough about the last two, the Valkyries, but I feel like we have just enough. But we'll start with Gwyn.
So with Gwyn, we see a little bit more of like a deeply impactful singular trauma. We don't have enough of her story to know if there's any sort of complex trauma in her past, but we do know the thing that sent her to the Valkyrie Squad in the first place was a very deeply impactful singular event that changed how she viewed herself. But we're also beginning to see some of that resiliency for her. And like Nesta, we also see that healing really starts when she has somebody to connect with, that she feels secure enough in sharing some of that trauma with.
I have a piece to add, but I think I'll add that after we talk about Emery.
Okay. Emery is another complex trauma case. Again, like Gwyn, we don't have her full story. I hope we do get their full stories. I think mm-hmm. that would be real fun and amazing. But she has a dad who's super abusive in a number of ways, but especially physically. And being raised in a society that doesn't see her as equal, human. I mean, they're not human. They're fae, but you know what I mean. Like a person. They don't see her as a person. They see her as a prize mare. And I think that there is, which is one of the reasons I hope we get her story, because I think there's a lot of people who can resonate with all of that. And again, isolated. She was super isolated too. And we see her start to heal that process through finding other people to share that with who don't judge.
So this is what I was going to add was between the three Valkyries, between Nesta, Gwyn, and Emery, their friendship and their healing together, and how they found not necessarily shared trauma, but they found like calls to like. Let's just pull that one out there.
Yep.
Whether it's positive or traumatizing, they found something in each other, and they were able to feel comfortable and open up and grow from it.
It's beautiful. And that's how healing of trauma works, honestly. It's the relationship that damaged you in the first place. It's a relationship that's going to heal you. It just may not look like the relationship you thought it would look like. And for Nesta and Gwyn and Emery, I don't think they would have thought that kind of relationship would be healing. But it was, because they had somebody who understood. They had somebody who they felt they could share with and do life together and know that they had their back.
Well, I think to bring in what we talked about earlier, it's community. It's why those three Valkyries were, I don't want to say successful, but became empowered. And that's why Valkyrie Squad in itself is that. We magically somehow recreated that.
I don't know how you did it, but you did. So good job.
I don't either. So someone please tell me what happened. Every day I'm like, what did I do? What did I
do? Only good things. Only good things.
All good things. I know. My husband every day, he's like, you say that like it's negative. I'm like, it's not negative. I just don't know what confusing. I did. I don't know what happened.
Well, you know, when you're in the right time and the right place, things just fall into place.
And then like calls to like, and it's all fine.
Yeah, and we're all searching for something.
Exactly. We're all here. So for those who are listening and thinking, what in the cauldron are we even talking about? Can we head to the library for you to give us some basics?
Yeah, absolutely.
So I don't want this to be like a definition session, but like, what actually is trauma?
Okay, that's a great question. And it is something that therapists debate all of the time. Depending on who you talk to, you're probably going to get a slightly different definition. But if we kind of boil it down to its real basic idea, trauma is anything that can completely overwhelm your ability to cope and often will shatter how you see yourself and your relationship with the world. Generally, it tends to break down the things that we have always held to be true about us or about how we function in the world, and really causes that to come into question. That's basically trauma, more or less.
It's a big question. So it's hard to like, again, it's hard to like narrow it down. Does everyone have trauma?
To some extent, yes. I think that one gets tricky because it is not for us to name other people's traumas. But the idea is comparative suffering. We often compare, oh, well, what I've been through isn't that bad, because so-and-so has it so much worse. You know, there are children out there who are raised this way and that's super traumatic and all of that, which is true, but that doesn't negate the trauma that other people experience, regardless of how quote unquote severe it is. So yes, long story short, yes, almost everybody has some kind of trauma.
I don't want to say inevitable, but it's something
kind of,
it makes us human in who we are. And I feel like it does shape a lot of us.
Yes, I agree. The one thing of the human existence.
Yes.
We can count on.
Yeah. It's always going to be some type of trauma. Always working. So what types of trauma are there? Like, there's a whole bunch of things on social media. And lately, it's this idea of generational trauma. I mean, we can start. I don't know how you feel about social media and what TikTok tends to self-diagnose us with.
That is a double-edged sword. On the one hand, it's a really good thing because it's getting more information out there. And when you have more information, you can see yourself in that information, and it can give you a place to begin your own research. On the other hand, it's like why we don't talk about why we try to minimize the news coverage of really traumatic events, of deaths or anything, because it opens up the possibility for other people to recognize that that's an option for them. And it's kind of the same thing. So sometimes you see something and you're like, well, I want to fit in that way. And you can absolutely misdiagnose yourself. But if you hear yourself in it, then you should probably do some research and see if that might be more true for you than it might not be. So that's TikTok and social media. There's some really good informational sources out there, and there are some people out there who I would rather nobody actually listen to because they don't know what they're talking about. And that's that. But there are several different outlines of trauma. That's kind of how I conceptualize it. Most of my clients fit one of maybe five outlines for what they're coming in for. How that story fills in for them is uniquely theirs, but the main points are probably going to all be the same. And so you can really break those down into like physical trauma, emotional trauma, spiritual trauma, sexual trauma, and then like the intergenerational trauma, which is a little a mix of both, or a mix of several of those. intergenerational trauma is a super buzzy thing right now. And there's been a lot of research on how trauma can change your DNA, which is where it's like, yeah, that's basically what you are experiencing. And so there is some genetic components to it, but there's also some nurture components to it, where it's like, we all have learned behaviors. We all have behaviors that we learned from our parents, and they learn those behaviors from their parents, and they learn those behaviors from their parents. And it's like the thing that's the old story about the wife who cut her roast in half, even though the pan could hold the whole roast. And her husband was like, why are you cutting it in half? She's like, I don't know. My mom just always did. And so they like start calling around, and they find out the reason they did it was because like the great grandmother didn't have a pan big enough for a full roast. So she'd had to cut it in half. And so it's this idea of continuing things you don't understand. And that's kind of what intergenerational trauma is. Like, it's the continuation of something you don't understand, but you were taught was true for whatever reason. And the other ones are a little more self-explanatory, I guess.
Bring social media back up into this. So last night I was scrolling through social media, and I'm half Filipino. And so I get fed Filipino comedians and things like that. And it was like, one thing that you need to stop do, like, toxic Filipino parents. And I watched it. I was all, that was true. Yep, I was a victim to that. I scrolled to number two. I'm like, ooh, yep. Scroll to number three. I'm like, ooh, oh. And I like shuffle over to my husband. I'm like, you need to watch all three of these. Please watch these. So he watches all three of them. I'm like, the way I respond to things now makes a lot of sense. Literally, my mother did this to me. And I know we watched her mother do it to her. I was like, oh, wow. This is, we love Joe Coy. We see Joe Coy talk about it all the time in his skits. And we're like, yep, that's funny. And then you see it broken down. You're like, oh, that's true.
I have to go rethink my life choices now.
Exactly. Like, on the lighter side, like, every Filipino, they make the joke that they'll save, like, the Cool Whip tub. And we'll clean it, we'll save it, and we always use it. And I was like, oh, that's funny. And I definitely broke myself of that habit. But there were times, actually, when I was setting up this office, I had containers of like cleaning supplies. And I was like, well, this is like a good container. I'll save this and store things in it. And I was like, what am I doing? That's not something we need.
Yeah. Or I could just throw it away. I don't need it.
That's on the lighter side of like learned generational things. Like, we don't need these.
And some of the learned behaviors are really good, right? Like, sometimes the learned behaviors can be how to appropriately deal with an emotion. And other times it's not those things. Interestingly enough, a lot of studies are showing that especially on the epigenetic side of things, the changes to your actual DNA, it takes about 3 generations for that to break on a DNA level. So we're seeing a lot of people enter into therapy being that 3rd generation of some really dysfunctional families. And it's really cool to see, because there's something about that 3rd or 4th generation that makes it easier to engage it.
Farther removed from it.
Yeah. And so it doesn't have quite the grasp that it would have over, say, your parents or your grandparents or your great grandparents. It's cool stuff.
It is. I like how you described generational trauma, because I've definitely heard the buzzword, and it didn't make a lot of sense. To me, at least, the way it was described on social media.
Yeah, it's a chain that gets passed down from generation to generation. And sometimes that's a chain that families themselves choose to keep forging. Sometimes it's a chain that society chooses to keep forging. And so you can see it on some more systemic levels. I know that that's a buzzword too, but my degree is in family systems. So that's what we study. We study how the ecosystem of people work together. And so there are some things that society likes to keep moving on down the line. You know, it's the TikTok of like, hey, would you like to go to therapy or double it and pass it along to the next person? That's generational trauma. Just doubling it and passing it on to the next person.
Just go. Nah.
Just have fun.
Package it up, pass it along. Here you go.
Oh, yeah. Well, I don't want to deal with it, so we'll let somebody else deal with it.
Well, on the like genetic piece of it, like down to the DNA, we hear there's trauma stored in the body, in a sense of whether it's DNA or in our muscles, in our bones. How do you recognize it? Because I could say my shoulder hurts all the time. That could be physical trauma, could be emotional trauma. I don't know.
So it's a lot of, this is the part everybody hates, because there's like no one right answer. I can't be like, this is how you do it. It's a little bit more trial and error for everybody, because how you experience trauma is going to be unique to your experience and how you function and how you cope with things. So how you store that is also going to be different. There are a couple of places that it does tend to settle, and we tend to see those in the places where you have the most nerve endings. So you tend to see it a lot in like the pelvic region, the stomach, neck and shoulders, and like the through the back, because that's where the vagus nerve kind of runs all the way down from your skull to your butt. And so anything kind of along that line is a really handy storage place. And that can depend on degree of severity. I'm trained in a process called brain spotting, which is it's very similar outcomes and engagement as EMDR, which is a much more popular method. I like brain spotting because it's a little bit more flexible for me. And so I can use it in a lot of different ways. But the premise of brain spotting is like your brain and your body are so interconnected that if your brain can't store it, it's going to push it down somewhere into your body. And so that's where, like, yeah, if you notice that you have some reoccurring body sensations, it can be pains, it can be more of like a felt sense of emotion, where it can be tingles or fire or like that burning sensation you can kind of get from anger, where it just feels like the pit of your stomach's kind of burning. Any of those things can be true. And the best way to figure that out is to pay attention to your body. You gotta learn how to listen to your body.
That sounds familiar.
Right? Right?
Huh. Okay. Yeah.
So it can show up in a lot of different ways. It can show up in illness. There are a lot of studies that seem to indicate that trauma and a fibromyalgia diagnosis are connected, and that almost any of the autoimmune disorders tend to show up in people who have unresolved trauma. That's not always the case, but there are a lot of studies that show there seems to be some sort of correlation between trauma and autoimmune disorders. Who knows? Yeah.
It's an open door. It's a big old open door of things.
And it makes sense. Like, trauma releases a lot of cortisol. And having too much cortisol in your system for too long can really start to do some really wonky, ravaging things to a body and cause a lot of inflammation, which a lot of autoimmune disorders have.
Is inflammation, yeah.
Yeah, so it's an interesting area of study. I am interested to see where it all goes, but right now there does seem to be some sort of correlation between that.
That's really fascinating. I've heard the more spiritual side of it all, like the spiritualists, like healing through that way. But I know it's not always
that simple.
Yeah, I'll say meditating on it enough and putting a crystal on it isn't always going to help the entire process.
But I have heard witchcraft just described as spicy psychology. So, I mean, maybe.
I think on some level it might like break the surface or like get you to a certain level. And then I think there's a whole other – this is my – I think there's – you can do a whole cocktail.
I do not claim enough knowledge to know how the world works. I will not rule out almost anything and be like, well, I mean, I'm – if it works for you, then why not? I don't, you know, like, go for it.
Try everything once. Why not?
Sure.
maybe.
Listen, my general rule is, as long as it's not harmful to you, the environment, or anybody else, have fun.
Put that as our disclaimer.
That is, yeah, that's my whole caveat. Like, yeah, as long as it's not harmful to you or anybody else or the environment, like, go, like, see what happens. And so that's where, yes, it can be hard to recognize, especially one of the things that trauma often does is it teaches you to doubt yourself. It teaches you to doubt your own emotions, your own thoughts, your own body, and to ignore all of the signals that you are sending yourself. Because oftentimes there is something that you're saying, this isn't right, this isn't safe, and everyone around you is telling you that it is. And so you learn to listen to other people instead of yourself. And so it's not an overnight process to learn how to figure out how it is showing up in your body specifically, but it does start with that whole like paying attention, being observant about how your body experiences things. For some people, there's not a lot of body sensation because they've just learned to shut that down so dramatically that they're like, no, my body doesn't ever feel anything. And you're like, oh, it's gonna
hit you soon.
And it's not gonna be fun, but it will be good, I promise.
In the end.
In the end.
Down the line. So on that, when it does hit us, like when we are triggered, should we acknowledge it versus avoiding it?
Always acknowledging it is better than avoiding it. And paying attention to it. It's going to be one of those things, especially at the beginning of any healing journey, where you're not going to have a whole lot of control over that. You're going to have the trigger come up and you're going to react because you're going to react out of that survival space. And this is where like working with yourself in that space is a lot like working with a toddler. You tell toddlers to do do-overs all the time, right? You're like, no, that's not how we ask for a cookie. If you want a cookie, you have to ask politely, and you make them do it so that they have that physical reminder. They get to hear how it sounds in their mouth, and we get to build those neural connections. And it's going to be the same thing when you're learning how to respond to your triggers instead of react to them. And so you're going to react. But the first step is noticing, hey, that was a reaction. I felt something really deeply, and giving yourself that time to kind of go back and like figure out what that means to you, where you felt it, what that experience was like. And then from there, you're going to build up that space to be able to choose the response, to be able to say, hey, I recognize that this is a very triggering thing for me, and here's what I need from you in order to help me heal through this. And so sometimes it's a, hey, that made me feel really unsafe. I need you to reward that for me. Can we find a different way to say that? But you're not going to know that until we've done the observational work. So acknowledge it always.
We'll take this from Valkyrie Squad too. It's progress, not perfection. You're not going to get it on the first try. You're not going to learn how to do a squat the first time I show you. You're not going to remember it when you walk away from that video. It's all a learning process.
And it's the repetition. Everybody wants to be able to be like, hey, I've mastered this and I'm never going to feel it again. But that's not how we learn. Like, we learn to walk by falling on our ass a lot. And so you've got to do that. You've got to crawl, and you've got to do all of the falling, and you've got to figure out. And that's why it's the trial and error, which nobody likes. And it's terrible. And I'm sorry. But if you can cultivate curiosity for yourself, you're going to get so much further in being able to sink into that trial and error of being like, hey, this worked for me. This didn't work for me. And that's where, hey, acknowledging the trigger is great. There are, like, I want you to give yourself completely over to it, but being able to say, hey, I recognize that this is something that is really triggered a deeply traumatic place in me. What do I need to do to help soothe that down? And then going and doing the things so that that feeling isn't overwhelming you helps create some of that safety to be able to engage it in ways that helps heal it.
All these steps.
So many steps.
You got to be patient with yourself too. So what should someone do when they think they have unresolved trauma?
So first thing would be find a therapist, because you're probably not going to be able to do it on your own, depending on what kind of trauma is there. And the reason that we say that is mostly because, like, hey, it can be a really overwhelming process, and having a place where you can go and know that you can take all of that stuff and put it into a room and leave it in that room so that you don't have to deal with it day in and day out. It's a containment. It's super helpful. Now, people work through their trauma on their own all the time, but this is like the whole like caveat of like, hey, I can't tell you to go do that because I don't want you doing something that's going to further damage yourself. So there are things that you can do on your own.
Maybe just don't scroll through TikTok and have them diagnose you.
and that's probably one of those things where, depending on your particular traumas and how you're engaging them, limiting social media is always a good idea.
Yes.
We don't need to be reminded of how terrible the world is all the time. But you can also find some really helpful communities to be a part of, to know that you're not alone. And that's a huge part of healing from trauma, is having that community of support around you. And that can come in so many different ways.
Amazing. And So back to your first like initial answer of like finding a therapist, I feel like a lot of people are scared to reach out for help or find help? Or are they, unfortunately, in the United States?
Can't afford it.
Can't afford it. It's you're in, the one person you want to go see is not covered by your insurance. It's you're in a limited area. Like, it is unfortunate.
It is incredibly unfortunate. And there are ways around that. If you're near a university or a part of a university, most universities have a counseling department. You're going to get the interns and the people who are going through a degree, and you're going to pay something really minimal or not at all, depending. It's most of the time better than nothing. That's just one where you have to be willing to say, hey, this isn't working for me and I need a different therapist, and find that fit that feels good, that feels like you can talk to this person. Because they're baby therapists. They don't know what they're doing yet. They're figuring it out just as much as you are. And so, like, you know, you're not going to get somebody who's been in it and doing it for 10 to 30 years and has bukus of experience. But that is a possibility. There are a lot of centers that hire interns. You can see it at an incredibly reduced rate. A lot of therapists will offer a sliding scale, but you have to ask most therapists for that. And that can look different. Some therapists provide scholarship slots. And so there are a lot of ways. If you're not opposed to religion sides of things, the Methodist Church usually will have relationships with therapists in the area and provide scholarships for you to see a therapist if you need it. They're pretty good about that. Some of the other churches do it as well, but it's not as consistent as the Methodist Church. I know several of the therapists in my area have relationships where they allow that. And so sometimes it's just knowing what's out there and finding a way to access that. There's a lot of nonprofit organizations out there.
I didn't even know that.
And stuff. Yeah, we have one here in Nashville area that does nonprofit. And so they do offer a really reduced sliding scale for people to be able to go and get therapy. And so I would say start there. Also, finding a therapist is a lot like dating on Hinge.
I was going to ask that. I was like, I know the process. I feel like it's like dating.
It is. It is absolutely like dating. And it's probably one of those things where we could figure out the like HIPAA concerns, having a therapist dating app, not like an actual dating app where you swipe through and be like, that sounds like a great therapist. Then have somebody reach out and be like, hey, I saw that we connected and that we might be really good for one another. You could probably make a butt ton of money off of it, but there's privacy concerns there. And so I don't know how I feel about that really.
But it would make it nicer.
It make you feel a little better. Yeah.
Well, a little bit.
Don't stick with anybody you feel uncomfortable with. Like that is the main takeaway there, is like, if you have a therapist that you feel like you're just kind of not vibing with, then that's okay. You can try a new therapist. If they make you feel really uncomfortable, please don't stick with them, because they're not going to be able to help you heal the way you need to heal, because you're always going to be, some part of you is going to be in that survival space of not trusting the relationship.
I think that's a good reminder for people, because we're like, oh, well, we're here. We might as well just, and maybe you tried out five other therapists and you got to this point and then you're like, oh, but it's not working. But I just did this whole process. I don't want to do it again.
So this can be sometimes where it's like helpful to, if you have friends in your life you trust, ask them, hey, who do you see? Even if their therapist can't see you, their therapist is probably capable of recommending some people who do similar work. And so, yeah, no, it's a networking thing.
No, that's great advice, especially for us in this country.
Yeah. The rules are different overseas, and degrees are also different overseas at what it takes to practice. Professional counselors, which would be LPCs here in the U.S., aren't really a thing overseas. You will see some marriage and family therapists. They do not overseas. A lot of countries are really starting to develop that program. But you're not going to see them. They're not going to have the same sort of prestige or training necessarily as we would have over here. They were there. It's mostly psychologists and psychiatrists are the ones who are like, would be our level of what we call therapy. And so it is a little different overseas, and also works a little bit different with insurances and healthcare and all of that kind of stuff. But they also have their own struggles about getting into therapy.
I'm sure they everywhere has some sort of struggle or trauma.
Yeah. Good news is if you're a social worker, you can pretty much move anywhere in the world you want to go because they are always looking for social workers.
Interesting. So we'll get back on topic here. So since trauma is in our bodies, can working out help deal with trauma just like it did for Nesta in A Court of Silver Flames?
Absolutely. One of the books that is the most popular for people to have read about trauma in the body is The Body Keeps the Score by Bessel van der Kolk. Dutch names are hard to say. It is not typically a book I recommend to clientele for a variety of reasons, but it is very popular and a lot of people have read it and a lot of research has been done on it. The long story, too long, didn't read it version of Body Keeps the Score is there are two things that help heal trauma. EMDR, which is the modality that Bessel helped pioneer, and yoga. He has since come out after some more research and had said it doesn't necessarily have to be yoga. It can be any type of body work. And so that can be anything from working out to yoga to Tai Chi to dancing to massage. Anything that is going to reconnect you to your body and help reintroduce you to your body and how you inhabit it is going to help you find those places trauma is stored and heal them and reconnect you with your body. So working out is great.
So on that note, please go sign up for Valkyrie Squad if you haven't already.
Well, and that's one of the things that I have loved seeing in the Discord is how empowering it has been for so many people to go through and reconnect to their body in a way that makes them feel powerful and makes them feel in control of their own body. And that's so important because that's what most trauma will do. It disconnects you from your body because we have to like dissociate from it in order to maintain the safety and the security of survival. If most of your trauma that you experienced was when you were 12, your body has, and you're now in your 20s, in your 30s, in your 40s, or beyond, like your body has gone through so much change from that time. But that point in time stopped the relationship that you had with your body and developed a new relationship. You have to have time to reintroduce yourself to who your body is now and how it has changed and what it is capable of now as an adult than it was as a kid. And that's true even if what you've experienced is trauma that changed that relationship as an adult. Five years makes a huge difference. 2 years makes a huge difference in who you are and how your body experiences the world. So anything that reintroduces you to your body is going to help.
We actually talked about this on the day we're recording this. The episode just dropped, The Sword and the Gremlin, and talked about the relationship of mind stilling and working out. And
yeah, I have not listened to that one yet. It is on my list to do later today. I didn't have a chance to get it, but I'm excited about
what?
It.
That
I
was saw your
it
homework. Was
like, yes,
Gremlins. That was your homework before.
I'm sorry. I just got internet back. Come on.
It's fine. You are fine.
Yes. And that's one of the things, like meditation is super helpful. Again, that's a trial and error. And that, I mean, that's what mind stilling is at its core. It's a form of meditation and that's trial and error too. Not everybody. Some people need a physical component into meditation in order to make it stick, which is why as therapists, we are always recommending yoga because it is a meditative thing. Valkyrie Squad has been that for a lot of people where there is a meditative thing that comes with moving through the forms and the flows and the things like that. And it's that pairing that how that mind and that body works together that can be very, very helpful for working through some of the trauma.
Okay, so before we started this episode, Elise and I were starting to talk about Ted Lasso and the amazingness of Ted Lasso. We'll try to keep this short and on a topic as much, but I feel like it goes with, at least for me, when I watched Ted Lasso and it came out, I personally was watching how Ted Lasso formed a team and relationship with everyone was crucial to me because I was stepping into this role of creating my own team and my own my own team and trying to figure out how to bring out the best in everyone. I use that as a therapeutic way to show me how I can do that in a positive way, because I talk like Ted does. I make ridiculous references. I make stupid puns.
And we love every minute of it.
I will start singing randomly, and I don't know all of the dance moves to Bye Bye Bye, but I know a good chunk of them. So I use, like, in the sense of like bibliotherapy, I was using it as my own video therapy.
Yeah. It's a form of narrative therapy. Yeah.
But withdrawing myself from, like, I need to see myself as Ted Lasso and how do I create a team. The overarching theme of Ted Lasso, and there, I apologize to everyone who hasn't watched Ted Lasso. There will probably be some spoilers. So if you are not caught up halfway through season three, sorry. But the overarching of therapy and anxiety and how the team deals with a therapist, how Ted Lasso is dealing with his own, just, you can speak so much more to this.
And it's all about the relationships you build, right? Like, that's Ted's thing, is he takes broken people and somehow makes them better through relationship. That's the root of how you heal from trauma. We see that help heal his traumas. We see that help heal the team's traumas. And we see them, and that's one of the things that I love about it. It does deal with some of the stigmas that come up with going to see a therapist, because people think you're broken, or which is asinine, because we're all broken. So it's like, none of us is unbroken in some form or capacity. And so, but we get judged for that and for not putting on this perfect veneer, especially if you're in a position where people look up to you and know a whole lot about you. You have to present this veneer. And we see that change, and we see them learn how to engage that and to do some really healthy things. And I'm excited to see where the rest of the season goes. But it's all about redemption. Like, the show's all about redemption.
It is. And I think, like you said, like, I think the way that Ted has to be in this leader role, but he has his own demons he has to fight, and it's portrayed very well. And yeah, the stigma with therapists, but I Ted even said it in an episode, and I can't remember, I think it was season two, where these sports professionals struggle. Like, we actually just saw this with, like, Colin and his identity. And this stigma we put on professional athletes, and this, they need to live up to this standard, but they can't be broken. Ted can't be broken. It's well done. It's so beautifully well done. And I'm so glad, from a therapist standpoint, like, it is shown so beautifully. And
it was like, I'm like, I can't tell you the number of clients I'm like, you should go watch Ted Lasso.
Same. I'm sure everyone near me is so sick of me. Yes,
you should go learn from this and then come back and talk to me. We'll have a conversation later.
Exactly. And I think that's what's so beautiful about the show. And I think right now in season three, it's actually, this is just my pure speculation of how social media is affecting each individual character and how it's, their brain is processing it.
Yeah, I'm interested to see what they do with that after the last couple of episodes, because it there have been some things that you're like, oh yeah, that's going to cause some problems somewhere down the line for somebody. That's going to be problematic. So how are we going to handle it?
Again, I apologize if anyone has not seen the show, but like Nate and his obsession with the Twitter feed and what people are saying about him and how that inflates his ego, and how we see that every day with, I don't know, TikTok, Twitter people, like, their ego just starts to inflate. And then,
but it's a false sense of ego.
Yeah. It's so beautiful. And everyone should go watch the show.
They should. If you're not watching Ted Lasso, you should be watching Ted Lasso. Brought to you by the Valkyrie Squad. It's just so good. It's heartwarming, and it doesn't focus on the bad things in life. It's just what everybody needs right now, to be reminded that the world is not as terrible as we think it is in some ways.
But I think, well, in like season three opener, how Ted and Nate approach situations so differently. Ted approaches everything with such a, his toxic positivity, but it's You could say it's toxic positivity, but it's so beautifully done that it's not toxic.
It is to him, though.
Yes, to him it is, but it's infectious. And it's beautiful that, and then you look at Nate, who decided to full on bash, and those parallels of each other, or not parallels, but those opposites and how a situation could be handled with the press or with anything. You could handle it by tearing someone down, bashing them completely, or, you know what, let's make a joke out of it.
I'll make fun of myself because I'm not going to take myself so seriously. And so, which can be good. It's probably not good for Ted, but it could be good.
I think on the outside of holding a team together and showing leadership, I'm sure it's the better side of it.
Yeah. Well, that's where we see Beard balances him out. Beard knows how to make wise choices most days. But when he doesn't, he makes some really bad choices. So there you go.
We'll wrap up our Ted Lasso speech here. Go watch it. Apple, sponsor us.
I can't guarantee it's going to help your mental health, but I also can't guarantee it's not going to help your mental health to go watch Ted Lasso.
Exactly. So back to community and Discord. There has been a lot of chatter about different techniques that may help someone's day-to-day, like we've talked about, mind-stilling. And I know you have mentioned one called the helpful finger technique, and others have mentioned the five senses technique, a grounding practice. Are there specific techniques you would recommend?
Yeah. So the five senses one is great. And for those who aren't familiar, it's where you take your five senses and you count down. And so you name five things, and they can change off of the situation you're in. If there's not five things you can look at, you can change that over to another sense. But you go down the line, and it's five things you can look at, four things you can hear, three things you can smell, two things you can touch, one thing you can taste. And then you just sort of fill that 5-4-3-2-1 in, however. And it acts as a really great grounding technique. I also really like the Roy G. Biv, which is all sight-based, but you look around and you go through the colors of the rainbow and you find a color that fits each rainbow color in order. That one is often more accessible for people and works really well for people who are like more visually minded because, you can find colors anywhere for the most part. Unless you work in a doctor's office, and then I'm sorry, you're probably better off with the 5-4-3-2-1. They're a little bland and boring. So if you work bland, boring places, then you might be better off with the five senses. The helpful finger is great. And it basically, you just take your pointer finger and hold it out about, 12-ish inches from your face. And you look at the tip of your finger for 3 to 5 seconds, and then you look through the tip of your finger for 3 to 5 seconds, like you have x-ray vision. If you've done it right, unless you're my weird ass mate, you will probably see two fingertips. He has some weird eye thing. He cannot see two fingers. He can do the magic eyes without crossing his eyes. So like he has a weird stigmatism. It's fine.
I'm literally trying this right now, and I'm like, that's why I'm laughing. Probably shouldn't do it with my reading glasses on.
You can. Doesn't matter. Because what it does is the way that your eye has to move to make that focal point. To focus on the fingertip and then to focus through the fingertip. Your eye nerve runs straight from your eyeball to the back of your brain and connects to that vagal nerve. And so this is a way to help activate that nerve, which is the biggest, it's our brake. That nerve is the brake of your body. It helps calm everything down. And so there are a lot of other things that can help do that. If you've ever been unlucky enough to have to call an EMT and they can't tell if it's a heart attack or a panic attack, they'll tell you to bear down like you're taking a poo because that helps activate that nervous system. And so there's a whole bunch of different things. Grounding techniques are great. They come in a variety of forms. ASMR works for a lot of people. Visual ASMR works for other people. But basically all of the main things that, we talk about, like being outside, walking in the grass barefoot can be a really great grounding technique. If you're into gardening, that's a great one. There's a whole bunch of stuff in the soil that can help really ground you and really help with anxieties and things like that.
Is that why Elaine likes to garden all the time?
Probably.
Peel back a layer of Elaine.
Just keep peeling. And again, that's where for some people, neurodivergencies can play into that too, what you find grounding. Versus a neurodivergent person versus a neurotypical is probably going to look a little bit different, mostly in intensity and duration. And so weighted blankets are great because that deep pressure from a weighted blanket can help activate that the brake system, that parasympathetic nervous system, and help slow everything down. They can be a little sweaty in the summertime though, so I apologize for that one in advance. Some people find that sensory deprivation tanks are really helpful for that, to just kind of recenter and to reground. And so, yeah, basically anything that makes you feel centered, calm, and grounded in who you are and everything is a great grounding technique. But these are the ones that we recommend up front.
Yeah, like home practice.
That you can take with you anywhere, because that's the trick, right?
Well, except the weighted blanket. You can't take that everywhere, but...
You can if you have a weighted hoodie, but they are expensive.
I can imagine. I did not know this existed.
They do. They're so great. They're great. They're just like wearing a hug. It's fantastic.
Amazing. Well, as much as we could go on about all the techniques, and we would all want to know all of them, we have your piece of cauldron-blessed wisdom today, Elise. So take it away.
I like to remember the wonderful words of Mr. Rogers. Anything that's human is mentionable, and anything that is mentionable can be more manageable. When we can talk about our feelings, they become less overwhelming, less upsetting, and less scary. The people we trust with that important talk can help us know that we are not alone. Having people you can talk to and be yourself to is vital to healing. This week, take a moment to go through your phone and identify the people who you trust and feel good about yourself after being with them or talking to them. Give them an emoji at the front of their name. You now have a quick way to identify your own Emery and Gwen for when you need them.
Oh, I love that. I have to ask, what emojis do you have in front of your people, your inner circle?
So apparently, the official name of the emoji I have chosen is State Park. And I only know this. It's like a little like, it's a picture emoji kind of thing where it looks like an outdoor with some trees and some rivers. And I liked it because it was pretty. So that's what I chose for me. But every time I tell it to call my mate, it'll say calling State Park and then his name. And I'm like, I don't know what to do about this. And so apparently it's called State Park emoji. And Google will read it out when you ask to call somebody with that in front of them.
That's amazing. And that is the best little tidbit I've heard about emojis.
But pick whatever emoji speaks to you. Some people do a strawberry or the little plant because those are the relationships that they feel help them grow. So if you have a favorite emoji that just speaks to your heart, use that one.
No, I love that. I was just very curious what you had, because I'll go do that now. But
mine is State Park.
State Park. I definitely know our producer Bex will put the hand heart emoji now on someone's, because she just figured out today that the Taylor Swift hand hearts exist.
That's amazing.
For anyone who needs to know, that is an emoji, and yeah, that's one. Thank you so much, Elise, for coming on the podcast today.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Of course. I learned so much. I'm sure everyone did as well. But until next time, be strong, kick ass, and be fucking magical every day. This episode was produced by Bex Castro, Mia Garlock, and Carolyn McMorrin. And a special thank you to Elise Zellmer for being on this podcast episode. If you would like to connect with her, you can email her at a.zellmer, Z-E-L-L-M-E-R, at inglenookcounseling.com. That's inglenookcounseling.com or on the website inglenookcounseling.com. Legal disclaimer. The content provided in this episode is intended for education, informational, and entertainment purposes only. Nothing in this content should be construed or assumed as clinical instruction or assessment, guidance, treatment, therapy, diagnosis, or to replace medical or mental health treatment. This episode does not create a therapist-client relationship. Our guest does not diagnose you or anyone else mentioned or described, nor do they teach you to diagnose yourself or others. Always seek the advice of a medical or mental health provider regarding any questions or concerns you have about your mental or medical health needs, If you need immediate help, contact your personal provider and or call 911 or your local emergency number. Special thank you to Taylor Ash for creating the music of this podcast. And thanks for listening to The Sword and the Ribbon by The Micro Squad. If you're interested in learning more about The Valkyrie Squad, visit us at thevalkyriesquad.com. If you're interested in learning more about The Micro Squad or Geek Gym for a class, visit us at themicrosquad.com. And make sure you're subscribed to the show wherever you get your podcasts from so you don't miss out. And if you liked this week's episode, please leave us a review.